Hello and welcome to the Wheeler Centre. You're listening to the podcast of our series Eavesdropping on Artists, which we presented as part of the Melbourne Festival 2014. It was recorded live at M Pavilion in the Queen Victoria Gardens.
My name is Luke Hockley and we are here at the M Pavilion in the Melbourne's Queen Victoria Gardens, which is located on the land of the Kulin Nation. And this evening we are eavesdropping on artists. It's a discussion panel that's been curated by the Wheeler Centre in partnership with the Melbourne Festival. And I think the run of things there where we're in the Queen's Garden, in the M Pavilion, on the Kulin Nation, really represents a lot of the themes that we're going to be discussing tonight with the works that we've seen.
Queen's Garden.
So I think the conversation we're going to have is going to be a real corker, so I'm very excited. We've got a panel of three artists discussing two works they've seen over the last few days. The twist is that each of the artists practices an art form that is different from the work that they've seen. The idea of the discussion is to uncover new ways to view the ideas in these works by talking with artists who, because they come from a different form, would themselves have made the works differently. It's an exciting insight into a bigger picture view of how artists make work and the broader context in which works are made. So, what are we discussing today? We're discussing two pieces, Team of Life by Cage, directed by Kate Denbrough and written by David Denbrough, in collaboration with a diverse cast of performers, dancers, football players, actors, singers, and with backgrounds including Indigenous Australian, Sudanese and Anglo-Saxon. It's a dance theatre piece that draws upon sporting metaphors to explore cultural identity in modern Australia. Also looking at Hip Bone Sticking Out by Big Heart, written and directed by Scott Rankin, in collaboration with a cast that can only be described as epic. Again, drawing from diverse disciplines, musicians and actors and dancers, they're Indigenous and they're non-Indigenous Australians from the Roebourne area and from many other parts of Australia with diverse cultural backgrounds. It's a theatre piece that tells the tragic and true story of a 16-year-old, John Pat, who passed away in the Roebourne lockup 31 years ago, an event that triggered a Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody. Both casts are made up of a mix of professional and non-professional performers. These two works use the medium of theatre to start a conversation about cultural identity in Australia. They explore a range of human emotions, including fear, isolation, joy and heartache. And I couldn't think of a more insightful, inspiring or knowledgeable group of people to explore such ideas with. We are in good hands. Now let me introduce you to them. Today we have Bindi Kolchocker. You're on my left. Give her a round of applause. Yes. Sue Giles. And Stephen Payton. Welcome. So I thought we'd do things a little bit differently, and instead of me talking to you about each of the artists and their work, I thought I'd get them to introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about their approach to art making, and possibly explain one of the works they've made in order to give you guys a little bit of insight into the way they make work. Maybe start with you, Bindi.
Okay. Hi, my name's Bindi. I'm a visual artist. I like to make photographs, video and installation. I'm formally trained in photography and I've done a degree in fine arts. I think I tend to make work that's uncomfortable, and which is probably good considering the works that we've seen. It kind of suits me. I will generally make very personal work that is probably quite voyeuristic in some ways, and almost, for me, therapeutic and cathartic. I began making work that was a little bit angry and preachy, I think, but I've moved on to making work that's more about how to move forward through things and how to heal and become whole. One of the first works that I made, which was for the Next Wave Festival at the CCP, was a series called Not Really Aboriginal, and it explored how dark you have to look to be considered Aboriginal. And I did photos of myself and my family, portraits of us, all in blackface. So basically I was I think I was turning us into the stereotypes that I felt everybody wanted to see. And I made it because for a long time, as I'd identified as being Aboriginal, people would say to me, but you're not really Aboriginal. And I guess I became aware of this attitude that there is a particular stereotype of Aboriginality, and if you don't look like that, you're not considered to be Aboriginal. And then furthermore to that, if you don't look like that but you are identifying as being Aboriginal, then it's because you're opportunistic. And so I made this work as a reflection of that, as a way to kind of take this discomfort that I felt around these attitudes out of myself and put them somewhere else, and in turn probably make everybody else uncomfortable.
I think but start you a really interesting conversation. Made a particular journalist uncomfortable in Australia, I do believe.
I did, and that work was actually seen by Andrew Bolt. And then he started to publicly vilify me over a number of years, and then I and a number of other people took him to court under the Racial Discrimination Act, and he lost. So that was good. Yeah. Yeah. So thanks. That's me.
Great.
Nice
thank
to
you.
Meet you all.
Nice to meet you, Vindi. Welcome. Sue, tell us a bit about yourself.
Thank you very much. Good night. I am a blank.
You can use interpretive dance. That's fine. I can describe what's happening for the...
Actually, Steve and I were just talking that, you know, the idea of eavesdropping, we're in a very sort of theatre construct here, and we should all be in a small box just talking, and then everyone does actually get to listen to us, and then we could say whatever we wanted, and we'd probably say a lot, I imagine. But that kind of brings me on. I make work that is not in a theatre a traditional theatre form. At Polyglot we make... experiential and immersive theatre, and also just explore children's capability and agency in the world is one of our big, big tasks. So the kind of works that we make can range from anything like thousands of cardboard boxes in a public space where people make huge cities and discover their own play with and drama within that, and works where babies and parents will be in an immersive space together with helium balloons and amplified baby noises, and then large community projects with schools and communities out where children create the work from scratch. So I guess the kind of the through line for my sort of work and our sort of work at Polyglot is about children at the centre of everything, and where does that take us? So the artistic exploration around that is really what drives all of us at Polyglot. And I guess I could illustrate one of my works, which I guess is the iconic one, is this cardboard box city. We built this city where thousands of cardboard boxes get piled into public space. We invented this in 2001, so it's been around for a very long time. It's gone all over the world. And every time you do it, it's completely different, of course. And the psychology behind the building and the way that people interact with the work becomes very personal to that city and to the people who are in there. So I'm really interested in the idea of communities and groups of people coming together to make something that is spectacular, but it's owned by everybody who makes it as well. And then you look at the sort of theatre that happens within that is extraordinary. Like the one we did out here at the Arts Centre, where I got invited down a tunnel with these children who are going, come with me, come with me. So we went down this tunnel in the cardboard boxes, around all sorts of corners and through sorts of nooks and crannies. And then at the end there's this box at the end, and I was looking at the kids with me, and they're going, knock, knock. So I knocked, doop, 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 and the box slid aside, and inside's a cave made out of boxes. And inside the cave are three children, and they looked at me and went, shh, we're rescuing a refugee. And then the box went, and I was, so they made this entire world that nobody knew about that was underneath that. And that's the kind of fascinating journey that the work that we create takes us. That's
fantastic. Sue. And so you're looking at deconstructing how we view theatre and what the norms of theatre are. Is that
absolutely
right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Great.
Which is why we should be in a box and you should be listening. On the outside. This is a nice space. Talk about deconstructing theatre. Take the walls away. It's great.
And Stephen, tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name's Stephen Payton. I'm a Gunai and Monero man. I'm from Gippsland. I also like to acknowledge that we're on Kulin Nation land here today. And for those of you who don't know where Gippsland is, it's about 2 hours east. So starts 2 hours east and goes right to the pointy end of Victoria. So the imaginary pointy line at the right down the end. So it's that huge area. So that's where I'm from. And a lot of my inspiration for my artwork comes from that place and my family and upbringing. So I work across installation, painting, sculpture. I do some digital work with video. I like to talk about kind of issues of race and colonialism and some of the brutalities around those colonial histories, and almost kind of educating people in what has happened in this place in the past, as well as getting people to kind of think about their position and where they sit in this place. So one of the works that I did, installation, was called Terra Nullius Lounge Room, which is at a little Ari on Gertrude Street. And the idea was that I asked people to come into the space and fold a paper captain's hat and then push their way through the gum trees and come and sit on a couch that I'd painted with my traditional markings on it, and sit there and watch a video a video work called White Man Premonitions. And so I was placing them in a position where they had to kind of really sit there and think about what they're doing and where they are. And that's how I like to make work. It's very kind of subtle and it's provocative, but still subtle. And I like to get people to think more so than spoon feeding people information. And I think that works better that way, if people kind of come to a realization themselves about histories and especially the history of this continent and where we are. I kind of deal with a lot of sometimes heavy topics as well, and I like to use either that kind of either humour or putting people in a position where they have to come to the realisation themselves. So, I'm kind of leaning more towards installation at the moment, but I do a little bit of painting and some video work just whenever I can. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks. Thank you. And so now I'm interested in knowing, maybe starting with you, Stephen, how do you see the difference between your practice and the practice of the works that we saw? So we saw two theatre-based works. You know, just briefly, what's the difference you see between what you're doing and what they're doing?
I think it's interesting with installation because you're kind of getting people into a room and making them look at something and making them be in the space and kind of take everything in. So there's kind of a similarity there. Mm. And I think the difference is probably maybe the time for me, the time that you spend in the theatre and the time that you spend in an art gallery. I don't know, when I look at art, I like to kind of walk in the gallery and kind of rush through and look at everything and then go back and digest it and go back to each individual bit. And
whereas a theatre piece, we sit in the room, it's linear.
Yep.
I watch it from beginning to end, it finishes. That's got that time is kind of set up for us rather than us having autonomy in that.
Definitely, yeah.
And maybe Sue, for you, what's your...
Well, in, similar to Stephen, in the work that we create is often in kind of a very rich visual world. It's installation. You move through it. It's experiential. But I guess for me also, the part of the difference in the work that I create and the work that I saw, I guess we're trying to make the process with the audience is part of the theatre of it, so that the theatre becomes the people who are involved in it, so that the people who have the most to say or be affected by within the work are the ones who are driving it as well, which takes you into different sorts of areas.
Great. And Bindi, how do you see the differences between your practice and the practice of the artists we saw during the festival?
Well, I just think there's so much more room for detail. You know, you can really expand on a narrative in a way that you can't so much with visual arts. You have to really get to the core of what you're saying and present that quite succinctly, I think. Also the reach, perhaps. You know, I think to see theatre, you have to go to the theatre. Theatre people go to see theatre. And then in a gallery, obviously, gallery people that like art go to galleries, but you can put your work online. You can get it out there to a much broader audience as well. And so I think that's probably another big difference.
Great. And so now to the works. So for each of you, I'm interested in your visceral response to the two works. So that could be a few words. It could be, you could say it in sentences. It could be just emotional. So what viscerally did you get from the two different works? Maybe starting with you, Bindi, seeing as you're on my left.
So you mean like a gut response?
Yeah, gut response to Team of Life and a gut response to Hip Bone Sticking Out.
I guess I was pretty moved by Team of Life. I thought it was very emotional and I kind of came away feeling... how did I feel? I came away feeling like I wanted to take action, or I wanted to do something, or I wanted to know more. And I was really, really saddened by the story that was being told, particularly the refugee story. And I felt like I wanted that to be told more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Hip Bone Sticking Out, visceral response?
Yeah. I think I had two responses to Hip Bone Sticking Out because the two parts are so different. I think after the first half I was just so overwhelmed and slightly bewildered, and it was just so much. It was like an assault on the senses. And I was less emotionally moved and more kind of stunned, perhaps. And then with the second half, I mean, I just bawled my eyes out throughout the second half, and I was again, just really saddened by this tragic story of this young man. But the two, it was... I think I needed the second half to deal with the first half and the way that it was presented.
Great.
Yep.
Thank you. And so can everyone hear okay over the fabulous helicopters we've got going? I'm just checking, and I'll just ask everyone to speak closely to the mics because I think it helps. Is that right? Does it help you guys? Yep. Sue, your visceral gut level response to these two works.
Okay. When I came out of... I absolutely agree with you, Bindi. The two halves were so different and they were like two different plays.
Yeah.
I guess after the first half I was going, what's going on here? I felt a deep awareness of the two aunties on the sides of the stage, and I didn't know... I wanted to know more about why they were there and what they and where those people were within the story. I left the hole thinking I want to know more about where the process is within this, and And that I felt, to be completely honest, I felt that I didn't feel that the people who the story was about, and it was an amazing story, and it was an incredibly strong piece on so many different levels, but I didn't feel that the people were at the heart of it. So I came away feeling kind of upset, but for perhaps not the reason that was intended by the makers. Team of Life, that it was a much more emotional piece for me, and it had a sort of a naivety about it that was very vulnerable, and I came away feeling that there was a lot of heart in that work that really connected with me.
Thanks, yeah. Sue. Great. Stephen.
Yeah, I'll start with Team of Life. For me it was like an instant kind of familiarity with the stage, I guess. Because I'm a visual person, it was a lot of the set dressing and a lot of the costumes and all that sort of thing instantly has an impact on me. And just the cars that were sitting there on the stage, and are we allowed to kind of let people know?
Let all the secrets out of the bag.
Yep.
Tell them everything.
Everyone's seen it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Beautiful. Details good.
So I was actually a soccer player as a kid, so there was kind of this instant familiarity, and also with the other side of the stage, having the caravan there, and then Uncle Kutcher Edwards came out on stage, and I've got a really strong connection with him, so there was just instant familiarity, and I just felt really comfortable and kind of ready to listen to the story. So that was my instant gut reaction to that one. And for the hip bone sticking out, I think that again, it was more of the visuals that really impacted on me, and kind of this colonial lens. What was it, like a sheet that dropped down?
Yeah.
It was like
a scrim.
Or something, with printed colonial images on it, and it's kind of, I kind of saw that as a lens. And then you've got this off kilter kind of stage. It's kind of semi like a boat. And it was very, it kind of set the mood straight away. It very, very much was off center, or kind of leaning down like that. So instantly there was this kind of unsettling feeling where you're ready for a story that's going to have this impact on you. So that was the gut response to each of them.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So what questions did the work raise, and how did the artists who were leading the investigation choose to investigate those questions? So what were the big questions sitting inside the work, and how did you view what the artists did with that? You know, what choices did they make? What choices could they have made? And whomever has a clear thought on that can be first.
There's a lot in there.
It's a hard question.
I mean, I can start, I think, with hip bone sticking out. I think with hip bone sticking out, the questions being raised were about this connection between what's happening today with violence and trauma within the Aboriginal community, or onto the Aboriginal community, being linked back to a long history of violence and colonisation, and it's just this continuing kind of line of colonisation. And so I guess that was the question, is there the link? Or I don't even know if there was a question raised. I think it was more a telling of this is why this is happening.
Yeah.
Because of this history. What was the rest of the question?
So once you've got the questions, how was that explored by the company, and what choices were made, what choices could have been made?
Yeah. I mean, it was such an interesting play. I feel like it was explored in a way, particularly the first half, that was very white. I don't even know if that makes sense, but it was like this white telling of this black history with a lot of references to theatre and that I didn't particularly get. I mean, I knew they were referencing theatre, but I didn't necessarily get the references because I'm an artist, not a theatre person. And so there was this... It was just so unsettling is a really good word for it, I think, particularly as I felt so unsettled. And I didn't know whether to be offended or angry or... I just went through such a range of emotions, and maybe that's what they want. They really want it to shock you and kind of really get up in your face. And
that was a very obvious choice, wasn't it? That first half had a lot of reference to Western theatre, Western culture, the lens. Why would an artist choose that lens? You know, like what
this
might be...
I wonder as well. I mean, I really do wonder about... you know, it's like kind of placing some sort of cultural legitimacy on the story by placing it into a theatre context that we all understand.
But not all of us understand.
No, exactly.
So then it pushes some of us out.
It's in a big proscenium, and it's a... I mean, the story is told. I mean, the questions in there seem to be about cultural legitimacy. Who gets to think about and react to these stories? Who gets to own the stories that are out there? Who gets to hear them? How do they get to hear them? Who's going to take notice of it because it's told in a particular way? Or, you know, that sort of stuff was thrown up again and again through both of those works for me. Of going, which is why I kind of wondered where the people were within that. So because the legitimacy of the big theatre stage and then the story being told within that context, what are we actually taking from that community? Where's the other forms that we're going to be exploring because of the people who are involved in that story? Mm. And for all of us, this is, you know... I'm just wondering about that framework that's been placed around both those works. And is that the only one we know how to tell story in? I don't think so. I think there's lots of other different ways. So,
Stephen, do you have any thoughts on it?
I tend to throw my glasses around and just throw them on the ground.
I think that you really have to think about the audience when you're creating work and the theatre audience is a particular audience and so I guess telling stories in that context you have to think about the framework that really kind of operates in theatre. I don't usually go to the theatre.
Which is why you're here.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of kind of emerging theatre and friends doing small theatre productions, but I don't get to the large productions a lot because we're artists and don't have much money. I think there was a lot of cultural references in there that were explained through either little quips, little humour bits.
The script kind of unveiled it, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that kind of explained it to that particular audience. They did explain the jokes or, the cultural references through humour. And I think Bindi said it before, it does have to be succinct, the whole thing. So,
yes.
That's kind of, it's very quick. And if you're not really tuned into it or you're not listening, you might miss those references or jokes. But yeah, they were in there. And I really liked the one where they were kind of talking these colonial accents and they were, you know, basically making fun of the colonizers and the Dutch colonizers and talking in these ridiculous accents and wearing a white mask and these kind of ridiculous outfits. And it was really funny. It was very, very clever. And I think they're dealing with these issues in a really clever and sophisticated way. I think there is a level of sophistication that you need for the theatre because it is such a short time frame that you have to kind of fit so much into. So,
but that would be my question. Do you have to fit so much into it? You know, there was so much in there. I mean, it touched on massacres and disease and just a long passage of time of colonization, and there was and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much that it goes into, and I think in that respect, one of the things I really loved about Team of Life was that it felt very poetic. You didn't need so many words, you didn't need so many stage changes, you didn't need all of these things to tell this quite emotional and beautiful poetic story, whereas this perhaps didn't have that same poetry. It was much more trying to get through so much stuff and bring it to you and maybe educate you. Or I think there's such difference.
I'm curious about Scott Rankin's work and Big Heart, and having a look at some of his history with making work. He appears to have a really clear agenda about talking to the dominant culture via the norms of that dominant culture. So he had John Howard in a theatre. He presented a group of young people from Tasmania who'd been marginalised, etc., showed a work where they were all, you know, emotive, connected, etc., and then at the end put two stats up. At the start of this work, every one of these kids was offending each week a criminal offence. Since they've been working in this piece the last 9 months, one offence. And so then John Howard and all these people apparently all went, oh, do the numbers on that. This is, culture is a good investment. You know, like, and that's, that I tell that because it's like he has a really clear, like this work, I felt like I was a white Australian being given a really clear narrative, a story, a history about what has happened, educating me. And then the second half trying to tell me, well, now we've got to go somewhere. Like, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that's what I felt the theatric choices were. And I wonder if that was on purpose to talk in the mainstream to the mainstream. I don't know. The white mainstream, sorry. Yeah. Apologies.
Yeah.
any thoughts on that, or am I completely off base?
Well, I actually thought we were let off the hook.
Okay.
I thought the entertaining nature of the work. I mean, the John Pat story is so amazing. And then, look, don't get me wrong, there were so many absolutely wonderful things about that production. But in the end, I did feel let off the hook as a white person going to see a piece of theatre. And I don't know if the point is to make change.
Yep.
And is that the point of the theatre that's created? Mm. I mean, if the point is to make change, then you know, it probably needs to be even much stronger than that, even.
Yeah.
Because although, you know, there was a lot of emotion in the room and people did take it very deeply, mm-hmm. which was wonderful to see.
But your question is, does it create the change that one is after?
Yeah, I guess if that is the point of the theatre, then. And in that particular form, is that the point of the theatre? Of both those processes are about getting people who are on the coalface, who are actually who are affected by the story in a very immediate and a very historical way, and taking it to an audience who isn't aware of that. Then is that about theatre for change?
Mm.
Mm. I don't think that piece was about trying to affect change. That's not what I got from it. And if I just feel like it was more about educating than about trying to show us how to move forward or help us moving forward. It was more just about you need to know this and this and this.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. And talking about the Dampier Archipelago and these histories that actually a lot of people don't really... I don't know if they don't believe it or whether they just don't know about, you know, Captain Cook not being the first white man to come to this continent. And a lot of people aren't actually aware that there was a whole series of other people that came here. So they're kind of talking about that, those histories, and as Bindi was saying before, you know, some of the continuation of the colonization some of the things that have happened in the past kind of coming up again and again and again, and kind of history repeating itself because people are not really aware of their histories. And if you know your history, then generally you don't repeat it if it's bad. But this is what they were talking about, I think. Mm. Yeah.
Because I did love that. Sorry.
No, go.
I did love that connection of that link, and I thought that was what was successful for me. In the most successful part of that show was that revelation of this long link, that this event is actually part of this link of horror and tragedy and all of that. That was a beautiful narrative to bring forth. That was the part that worked the most for me. But then I think what I needed was something, some way out of that, perhaps. And I don't know if I was given that.
So go, Susan.
No, I was just going to say, does it make you drop the story if there is no way out, do you think? Like, is the resolution really important in that circumstance?
I wasn't really sure what happened at the end of that. I didn't really know what was going on towards the end of the show, and then it just kind of finished. And, yeah, maybe they were... posing this question, maybe they were getting you to think about it, or, you know, maybe it was heading down that
there
path.
There was a sense that it was opened up to the audience at the end, wasn't there? There was a sense of, like, it kind of just stopped, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was also taken away as well, yeah. I felt like. It was like, here's all this information and here's all of this this emotion and this full-on stuff. But then it kind of was taken away from us at the very end too, with the "Do you feel sorry now?" And I don't know. It was just so.
Well, this is why I think it was let off the hook for us as well, because he kept on kind of going, "Oh, sorry, made you sad now." He didn't let us go there, you know. So it was like yes, you don't have to cope, or you. There was this. There was a funny feeling of being pulled and pushed in different directions, yes, towards the end.
Just before we move on, because we'll talk about Team of Life in the same way.
Yeah.
But just before we do, how does that whole series of things you've just talked about there with that work, how does that reflect the broader conversation that Australia is having with these issues? So we're having a dialogue around these questions. Is it the same? Is it different? Like, does that just reflect how we're feeling each day, or are we actually more advanced than that in our conversation? Or,
I think in terms of that particular work, I feel like I want to move beyond that type of conversation, to be honest. I think there's already been a lot of education, and there still needs to be that conversation, but I want people to bring me narratives and storylines and works that help me to move into the future, rather than sit in this stuck kind of position of being stuck and not moving forward. And I just...
It is an issue. We don't have it anywhere else, I mean, this is, it's not taught in schools. It's, we don't have that. That history is not part of our history.
Yeah.
And it's still not. It's not given. That's not. It's not given cultural space in Australia the way it should be. If we are going to move forward, we've got a long way to go to actually settling what it is we want to talk about. This is there. You know, there is no treaty. There is no acknowledgement. There's no sort of public. Public moving forward on every level rather than just the arts. We talk about it in the arts potentially more than anything else, I think.
But does the constant going over of it, the constant kind of anger and resentment and pain and bitterness and the compounding of this, I'm just wondering how helpful that is.
I think it's really helpful.
Do you?
Yeah, I think that the more people that know about it, the better, because... Actually, a lot of people in this country and a lot of kids at school are just not learning about this stuff. And there's a lot of people interested in Australian history, but it's being kind of brushed over and washed over. And, you know, it's very hard to get people's attention these days and get people to actually listen to what you're talking about because... There's so much going on, and you know, people very rarely listen to you and take in what you're saying. It's just kind of brushed over. And I think the more that you kind of hit these things home at people, the more they're going to take it in and actually think about it, and maybe they'll learn something, or maybe they'll want to learn something. They'll ask some questions and think about. Themselves in this country and think about the true history of Australia on this continent.
Which is great, but how does that help the Aboriginal community move forward?
This is why it needs to be across the whole of society, not just in story.
Yeah.
It needs to have action, you're right. We need to take action.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's probably a disconnect between what... you know, in change in a society, there's always the awareness raising. Like, there's a level where everyone has to become aware of the issue, and then there's a level of action that happens. So, and so I think it can be a mismatch between one group being clear and aware of an issue and the whole society being clear and aware. And so I'm curious as to whether... So I hear from you, Bindi, well, actually, no, we're already there. We need to move on from here. Whereas maybe, Stephen, I hear from you, no, we're not quite there. We need to get more of this across, and that's why this work works in a way, because it brings that conversation to the Melbourne Festival, to a main stage, so that, you know, honestly, a white middle-class audience can hear that.
A different audience,
Can hear that. And so, I'm curious. You know, you both just talked to that beautifully, really. I think that's really interesting. I will move us to Team of Life, though, because I'd love to have some more reflections on that. So, again, what questions does that work raise? So, and how were they tackled by the artists? And we've heard a little bit of that. It was almost more sparse or abstract in some ways, its exploration. But if any of you'd like to explore more the issues raised or the questions raised and how the artist explored them.
I think it's a big question about how the AFL operates myself. But
yes.
How is that?
Oh, well, you know, television's taken over. Let's face it.
Yep.
Where's the game? No. sorry, I butted in.
No, I wasn't.
Go, Sue.
This one, the questions, I mean, in a way, it's a much sort of broader question about the multicultural nature of Australia, I suppose. I mean, because we have, with this one work, you've faced the issue of people who've arrived with story, who've got story that's come to the land as well, which, you know, in a nation of immigrants, this is to be expected. But in particular, again, that issue of colour and that, you know, that line that Mick says, which is people aren't that friendly to black faces around here, so thought I'd say hello. So those, I mean, in a way, this play kind of placed more gently and more humanly the issues that are faced every day as well. So, and again, the you know, that terrible story that's told by the Sudanese man through it at the beginning. which puts it all into a particular frame. And you know, the abstract nature of that work was fantastic. The dance and the soccer. I'm a soccer player myself, Stephen. We should have a kick later. Yeah.
Everyone's welcome to join.
Sure.
Yeah, it's enough for a couple of teams here. It's going to be really great.
That will be immersive discussion panel.
Yeah, and we'll talk while we're kicking.
Yeah, there you go. Now, Sue, you got your wish to deconstruct the panel.
Wouldn't that be funny? So the questions raised by it were I think that the my most striking moment for that piece was when the man was standing completely still, and then that huge warm up training session was happening around him, and those different forms of endurance were really clearly stated.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
And so for me, the kind of the more literal sense. Is that my glasses again? Literal sense. Thanks, Tim. The more literal sense of the play within that was it was almost not necessary in a lot of ways, because the dance can tell that subtext really strongly, and I guess I'm really particularly interested in subtext. So,
Stephen, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I really love this work. It was as I said at the start, it was very familiar, and I think it dealt with, again, some heavy issues in a really sophisticated way, and kind of talking directly to the audience and explaining some things that maybe people may not have got, or not everyone would understand. My connection with Uncle Kutcher was... it's really strong, and the point where he came out and sung the Australian anthem and it was reworded, it really, really, really affected me, and it was so powerful. I think it's a game changer.
Yeah,
and
I've got goosebumps again now.
Yeah,
as I had in the moment.
Yeah, and I've never seen an audience react like that. Everyone clapped afterwards. In the middle of the production. So I'd like to see him sing that at the MCG, at the grand final.
That's, okay, well, we'll get that to happen. Yeah. I'll just get my people onto it.
Great. That was amazing.
And I think that's potentially an example, Bindi, of the thing you were craving, that idea of, okay, well, we've been there. Now, I think what that moment did beautifully was just illustrate where we are going, what is next, how to own that as a... Because I felt it took a song that we all own and then placed a culture and a language inside that reinterpreted that for us and made us one, you know, which is... that's what it felt like at the time.
And that's what I loved about it too, was that...
Thank you. It keeps falling down.
Was that idea of a global identity through sport, that we do all have these common connections, and we're not so different and not so separate, but we can all come together through certain things and move forward, which I really
There's
like.
That moment when everyone's watching, like all these bunch of shy strangers in someone's backyard, just watching the watching the grand final. Like, Lisa, come and just watch the grand final. We don't know anyone gone.
So. It was very cute, and the kids I loved as well. When the kids came on stage and ran around, and it was just very heartfelt and heartwarming, and it was an interesting and it really allowed you to come in to the narrative, and it took you through it, and it kind of. It was hopeful, and there was a hope to look forward to, that through this kind of coming together, this global identity, the things that join us together rather than separate us, we can move forward. And perhaps that was what was different about the other one, was that there was a separation. It was an us and them. This has happened, and you should know this. You're not really part of it, but you need to know it. And yeah, it was just a very, very different way of telling stories and a story.
What do you think about... Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes, Sue,
what do you
please.
Think about, what do you think about... I mean, I got a sense of inequality on both of those stages, though. There was a sense of inequality because of the mixture of... how was it phrased? Professional and non-professional.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's what I said. I didn't see that written anywhere.
You made that up.
I made that up because when I looked at it, I couldn't find in the program any reference to that. But from my perspective, I saw performers who had a diversity of training. Some were, you know, clearly went through university and had training, and others had been potentially trained through the project. So I didn't know how else to say it.
I don't know if dancers usually juggle soccer balls like that. I've never seen that.
No, I know. How cool. That was a great
I don't know if
example.
I saw that, but that was, it was pretty was spectacular. Pretty impressive. Mm.
And that was a great example of a non-dance, a sporting professionalism or athleticism on stage mixed with that was just really super.
It was great.
So I've got, a big question now. Both of the works are example of one culture collaborating with another culture in order to tell their story, to help tell their story. So both directors of the works were from different cultures to the story that they were telling. And that's a pretty big thing.
Yeah.
And I was really curious about how can someone from one culture help another culture tell their story? Is that a great thing? Is that what should happen? Do we need that to happen? Have you ever done that? Anything on that question, any thoughts you have on that area would be more than welcome.
I think collaboration is the word to use because it is a collaboration with those other groups of people and kind of working together to tell a story that is from a particular group or I worked with a friend of mine who's European origin Australian and I had to kind of explain to him about collaboration and what we were doing and whose story it was that we were telling this is a project called Buren's Canoe where I'm with my
is that the photographer
and,
who
it was a photographer with? Yeah so Cam Cope he through meeting my family and going down to Gippsland and kind of talking through these issues and talking about it just openly what are we going to do, how are we going to tell this story, he really understood that it was a collaboration but also that the main voice it's our story. So
and he actually commented in a video I watched where he said he started out thinking he would do an ABC of how to make a bark canoe. He was going to photograph it and then he moved to a place of, oh, hang on, I'm more capturing the essence of this experience rather than the... So I think that's an example of how that shift happened in that project maybe.
Definitely, yeah.
You guys, any thoughts on this question of one culture working with another culture?
I think it happens all the time and it's a good thing. And I just think it needs to be approached with sensitivity and respect and honour. And I think honour is probably the key thing amongst all of those things, is that when you are working with somebody else's culture, you really need to follow protocol and work very gently in a way, tread carefully, tread lightly with the community that you're working with, which isn't easy to do because you want to tell the story that you want to tell. Mm. Like in your example, you don't necessarily get to do that, I think, and I think that probably happens in most collaborations when you're working with a minority community is that you go in with a preconceived idea and you come out with something entirely different.
And both projects, it's to note, were very long processes, like 3 to 4 years in process. And I think that is testimony to that notion that without collaboration, this kind of work can't be made. Sue, did you have any thoughts on that question? Or
I'm absolutely in agreement. Collaboration, I mean, that's the key to it. And certainly from a white theatre maker perspective, the desire to tell important stories that belong to this country is very, very strong. And the only time I've really felt legitimate in doing that was to have a co-production with Ilbidgery Theatre, where we worked together on a piece. And in that piece, you disappear the idea becomes the thing between those two organisations, and so everyone kind of disappears until we reform. And I think you're right, everything changes. As soon as you enter into a collaboration, everything changes. And to be open to that sort of change is perhaps the most exciting thing you can do as an artist, because you get taken down roads you've never travelled. And that then changes the way you think about everything. So that was an enormous privilege for our company to do that, and has maintained a friendship between those two companies ever afterwards. So, you know, I feel I know some people now, which is cool.
Having said that about a collaboration, I'm really not very good at it. No, I'm definitely a solo operator.
Yeah. A singular vision.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's for some people and not for others. Mm, yeah. Mm.
So, sorry, Stephen.
I was just going to say it is very difficult to collaborate with people, and I think it does take an open discussion and listening and actually talking honestly about what you want to achieve and what stories you want to tell. And it is hard sometimes when you have people of different disciplines or different backgrounds, and it's just about having an open conversation.
It's difficult with very strong, opinionated people at times, though.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
The joy of making art.
Not that I'm
art.
One.
Choose your collaborators.
And so if you had to take those themes and use your chosen medium, so either of the works, any of the themes that are there, you know, I'm not even after the work you'd make, but what would be the first steps you would take? You might have the work already clearly in your head, but how would you represent this question or these questions in your work? Drum roll, please.
Silence.
Just a little question to finish.
Yeah.
Can I start?
Yeah. Yes, Stephen, please help us.
I would have a soccer game in the park. Just an immersive installation of many nations against each other. Yeah,
that's good. And I'd photograph it.
Yeah, I'll be on the same side as Stephen. The fact that there was a silence there, I mean, is really interesting. Both these companies have gone through a huge process, have done it authentically, and have done it with an enormous amount of heart. And so, in a way, theatrically speaking, they've done the best possible job they can.
Yes.
There's so many different ways to get the kind of transformational shift that you're after for an audience as well. And I think soccer game would be a great one. And also, the potential to take it from an abstract point of view, to take it into all sorts of different art forms. I think the questions that are raised by these two works keep needing to be asked and keep needing to be explored. Everyone here will have a different way of looking at that and making that happen. So
that's right, and bringing their own stuff to it. And as I keep talking about, I think if I was to approach something, probably particularly with hip bones sticking out, I'd really look at how to heal from this and make something that's about having a cathartic experience, being able to heal and probably forgive, which is really probably quite controversial, and move forward.
Yeah, because, you raise a great point. We always view work through our own lens, don't we? And you talked of earlier in your career you felt more angry and you had more angry work, and now you're coming to a place where you're dealing differently with your work, and then you view the works from that lens.
That's right. Yeah. So it is about where the artist is at as much as it's about the narrative that they want to tell. Yeah.
So last question. You get a chance to chat with anyone from any of the casts, and you can ask them a question or say something to them, something about the experience you had. And if you don't know who the cast member was, you can just describe them, or the director, or whomever. Who is it you'd ask a question of, and what would you say, or what question would you have?
Oy, oy, oy.
Boy. I'd sit with the aunties.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know what I'd say, but I'd
You'd
probably
sit
in
them.
Silence and just go, anytime you're ready, just talk, that's fine. No, I just sit with the aunties. I would love to know. I would love to know their perspective on what was created.
Yeah, that's good.
That's what I would like to know.
Great. Stephen or Bindi, any thoughts?
I'd talk to Uncle Kutcher.
Can I talk to Uncle Kutcher too, please?
Yeah,
you're both allowed.
Why don't we all talk to him? I just want to know who wrote those words, who wrote the lyrics to that song, because I think
Judith
that...
Durham
hang on,
did.
Judith Durham, but in partnership with him and someone else, I believe.
Go on.
Please, go. Oh, no,
who
no.
Did?
I... In part, and was there someone else as well? No, Judith Durham and Kutcher.
And Kutcher.
In partnership. Yeah. Beautiful.
It was amazing. I think
perfect.
That,
if that could
get them out
anthem.
There, change the national anthem,
yeah.
Which should be those words.
I'd stand up for that.
Yeah.
Thoughts, Bindi?
Yeah. Maybe I'd like to speak to the audience of Hip Bone Sticking Out. And I'd just love to know what people really think.
Here we are.
About
we
it.
Have the audience.
Yeah.
And we have a microphone. So is there anyone in the audience who would like to talk to Bindi about their experience? Yeah, jump. There's a microphone just up over here, if you don't mind making your way over there.
Okay, so I agree with your observation that it felt like two different plays. I did a bit of research beforehand, and so I knew the John Pat story, and I think that really helped. I don't think the play told us about the Royal Commission very well, and I think that's part of kind of what Sue was saying about the moving forward, because we didn't get that strongly in the performance. That was kind of, I think, their statement that that's the first step of the moving forward. Mm. And in particular, I think, because I went to Tanderham as well, and I'm thinking about the national anthem in traditional language, and... I actually think that a lot of the messages of all these works are actually about moving forward and finding ways to be together. And for me, Hip Bone Sticking Out, that first bit was about this is how we got here, but knowing that, what comes next? Mm. And that's the question I think that was opened out to us is, okay, we know this is where we are, how we got here. Now it's up to us. They gave it back to us to say, okay, you've got the information, what do you do next?
Mm.
And examples of what to do next were the anthem, were Tanderham, and I think that the festival's done that really, really well.
Yeah, great. Thank you. There's an audience member who's given us one conversation with Bindi. Anyone else who saw the works who wants to make a comment on that, or no other enthusiastic punters? Yes, there is one up the back there. Go on, head over to the microphone. I'll sing while she's walking up there. No, I won't.
I suppose, to the comment about, Bindi, your response to Hip Bone about where do we go from here and the presence of the aunties on stage, I think it's quite a beautiful thing when you think about the aunties, in fact, invited a big heart into the Roebourne community because some of the issues they were having with the youth. And having a lot of the young people on stage actually being sentenced to theatre making, being in that production, I think some part, I think, I haven't seen it yet, but I've know a bit about it. But I think with the aunties on stage that they are in fact watching people in their community going forward. And
that's good.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think that's very successful, and that's how
thanks, great
it
to know.
Works.
Thank you.
It works in terms of moving the Aboriginal community forward.
I need to thank you all for being so fabulous. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time chatting about this. But can you join me in thanking our generous, fabulous panel, Sue Giles, Stephen Payton, and Bindi Cole Trocker. So my name's Luke Hockley, and you've been listening to Eavesdropping on Artists, an initiative of the Wheeler Centre in partnership with the Melbourne Festival. Thanks so much for coming along today.
Thanks for listening to Eavesdropping on Artists. Don't forget to check out wheelercentre.com for more on books, writing and ideas.